This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
the worst of the famine threat has been averted. However, the damage to lives and livelihoods, particularly women, children and marginalized groups, has been extensive. 900,000 people have been newly displaced in the last 9 months. And the risk of famine still remains.
That's UN Special Representative for Somalia, Michael Keating, briefing the Security Council. Details coming up.
Also, Uganda's ruling party says it will introduce a motion in Parliament to scrap the presidential age limit in the Constitution. Women in Malawi marched through the country's capital today demanding stronger penalties for domestic violence.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: a top UN official says the worst of the famine threat in Somalia has been avoided. However, he says many people continue to suffer from its effects. UN Special Representative for Somalia, Michael Keating, briefed the Security Council yesterday.
The long-term as well as immediate challenges facing Somalia remain formidable, whether humanitarian, economic, security, or political. The unity of the Council and the solidarity of the international community have been essential to the gradual, if fragile, progress that is being made. At my last briefing in May, the humanitarian crisis was deteriorating fast. Thanks to the swift and generous contribution of more than $1 billion for humanitarian action since the beginning of the year, agencies have been able to mount a famine prevention response reaching over 3 million people per month. The worst of the famine threat has been averted. However, the damage to lives and livelihoods, particularly women, children and marginalized groups, has been extensive. 900,000 people have been newly displaced in the last 9 months, and the risk of famine still remains.
Keating said Somalia remains vulnerable to drought.
An imperative for Somalis is to escape the vicious cycle of recurring weather-related shocks. Humanitarian and development partners are coming together to build institutional capacity, strengthening resilience and boost productivity in line with the Secretary General's new way of working. The federal government, supported by the UN and the World Bank, is developing plans for a comprehensive post-disaster needs assessment of the impact of the drought and a recovery and resilience framework to reduce the risk of famine.
The UN Special Representative said the Somali government is determined to improve security, create jobs, and pass key legislation. But Keating warned it faces many challenges, including a lack of time and high expectations.
Its honeymoon period is over. Somalia is not the first government to experience this phenomenon. Immediate political challenges are complicated by ill-defined relationships between the federal government and federal member states, between the executive and the legislature, between the newly formed upper house and the House of the People. Other challenges relate to politicians and power brokers using opportunities to advance their own clan interests or personal ambitions, using tools such as threats of impeachment and motions of no confidence. The key issue is whether the federal government will be successful in managing these constituencies and in preventing them from threatening progress on core objectives and the stability of the state.
Keating outlines some issues he says the Mogadishu government should address immediately.
Immediate issues that are currently creating strains in the relations between state institutions include the controversy over the transfer to Ethiopia of a well-known Ogaden National Liberation Front figure and the reverberations of the government's determination to maintain a neutral posture in the dispute between important Gulf partners. They also include simmering disputes around the country, including in Hirshabelle and the impeachment of the state president there, the political standoff in Galmudug, where the state president has been unable to advance power-sharing and reconciliation talks with Al-Sunna Wa Jama'a, and tensions in the lower Shabelle. Unresolved, these could undermine the gains made so far in the state formation process. Resolution is needed of key issues that will define the federal state, including the division of powers, agreements on revenue and resource sharing between federal and state governments. They also include the structure of the judiciary, the status of Benadir region in which the national capital is located, and the formalization of the status of all federal member states.
The UN Special Representative for Somalia also told the Security Council that al-Shabaab militants remain a potent threat and that the security situation remains volatile. He said funding for the AU mission in Somalia, AMISOM, is critical.
Uganda's ruling party says it will introduce a motion in parliament to scrap the presidential age limit in the constitution. The move would allow longtime president Yoweri Museveni to run in the next elections. But the motion is already sparking resistance, even from some in the president's own party. Halima Atumani has the story from Kampala.
The speculation is finally over in Uganda. Members of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party said Thursday that in a week's time, they will introduce a motion in parliament to abolish the presidential age limit. Ruling party MP James Kakoza says the age limit is discriminatory.
Because you cannot say people will be the final verdict to choose the people they want in elective politics, and you discriminate them because of their age that they are old.
But opponents say the proposed amendment is a ploy to keep President Yoweri Museveni in office. Museveni has already been in power for more than three decades. Uganda's constitution sets the presidential age limit at 75 years. Museveni would be 76 years old when the next election rolls around in 2021. Musician Bobby Wine was recently elected to parliament as an independent. He came out against the proposal Thursday, saying Museveni's government is responsible for widespread poverty, unemployment, and violence at the hands of the state.
We only have this one chance. We must make the pledge that we shall not allow this amendment to pass. My brothers and sisters, we must defend the constitution before it is too weak to defend us.
There is also opposition within the NRM. VOA spoke to ruling party member Barnabas Tinkasimire.
This country belongs to all of us. His time is over. 35 years for God's sake. Uganda is raised up. Let us not be taken for granted.
President Museveni has not said publicly whether he supports eliminating the age limit. When asked about the issue by reporters at the State House Wednesday, the president said it is up to parliament.
So for us, our work was finished. The rest is now for you, the young people, and for the MPs and other leaders to discuss the interests of Uganda and the interests of Africa.
However, Museveni also urged anyone who doubts his fitness to lead the country past age 75 to speak to his doctors. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Rumors on social media of attempted vote rigging may be behind yesterday's attack on a women's group in Kisumu, Kenya. Reuters reports police used tear gas and fired their weapons in the air to chase away young men who attacked a Christian women's organization. Police say they entered a hotel room and broke windows and smashed chairs and then used the pieces to assault the women. The women's group denied rumors on social media and WhatsApp that they were planning to rent voter registration cards. They said the meeting was about holding peaceful elections. A new presidential vote is scheduled for October 16th. The Kisumu area is a stronghold of opposition candidate Raila Odinga.
Radio France International reports that two UN experts who were killed in the DRC earlier this year may have been set up to be murdered. An investigative report says Michael Sharp and Zaid Ketlin were deliberately misled about security in Bonkondo in the Kasai region. The area has been the scene of fighting between government forces and local militias since August of last year. That's when a local tribal chief was killed. The UN experts had gone to Kasai in March to investigate reports of more than 40 mass graves. Their bodies were found 16 days later.
UN You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiswu Heeb. 15 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. A top UN official says the worst of the famine threat in Somalia has been avoided. And Uganda's ruling party says it will introduce a motion in parliament to scrap the presidential age limit in the constitution. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
More than 100 Nigerian girls who had once been kidnapped by Boko Haram militants in Chibok are going back home. Nigeria's Ministry of Women's Affairs held what was called a send-forth dinner for the girls yesterday. Reuters reports the girls had been staying at a government facility where they received medical care and psychological counseling. About 270 girls had been abducted by Boko Haram from a school in Chibok in 2014. Since then, some have escaped or were freed by the military or after mediation with Boko Haram. The Minister of Women's Affairs, Jumai Al-Hassan, says the girls are now okay. They are ready to reunite with their larger families. Reporter Jack Vince is following the story from Maiduguri, capital of Borno State. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
There was a dinner to officially tell Nigerians and the world that the girls have been rehabilitated and are ready to go back to school. But the people responsible for catering for these girls, the government and her agencies responsible for rehabilitating these girls, kept everybody in the dark. They didn't want anybody to know the procedure or how this rehabilitation work was being carried out. But one thing I know for a fact is that UNFPA is directly involved in rehabilitating the girls. And over the years, UNFPA has been known to have some level of credibility. So what happened was that they did that dinner to commemorate the return of the girls and to tell the world that the girls will now be going back to school. But it is not very clear whether the girls are going with their parents to their various homes or they are going to a school specifically prepared for them. This is the two things Nigerians are not very clear about.
Jack, can you tell us where the girls underwent rehabilitation, medical care, psychological counseling, and where was this dinner held?
Everything happened in Abuja, the federal capital. Everything happened there, but they were secluded. They were kept out of public eye. It was in Abuja that they had a center where these girls were kept and trained and taken care of and given the requisite training that we were told they were given. But another thing is, we don't know for a fact specifically where these girls are, because as I speak with you, members of the Bring Back Our Girls group, the frontliners in the advocacy for the girls, have not met the girls. They have not seen these girls. So maybe the government, in her judgment or in her wisdom, knows the reason she is keeping these girls out of public eye.
Is there still a chance these girls will face stigma and discrimination because they were abducted, even though they underwent various psychological treatment, for example?
In Borno State, the likelihood of these girls being stigmatized in the place they came from, which is the southern Borno, is slim. They may not be stigmatized because they were with the insurgents. And this is because of the high level of understanding amongst the people of southern Borno. But in other parts of the state, there may be the likelihood of these girls being stigmatized. But as I talk to you now, we have more people sympathizing with the girls and are willing to help them than those who would want to stigmatize them. That is the truth of the matter.
Do you have any idea how many girls who have been abducted by Boko Haram over the years are undergoing rehabilitation at this time?
A lot. Specifically, I can't say the particular number, but I know over 1,000 people were rescued. And UNFPA and the MSF, that is Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, have been attending to these people civilly. And I know we have up to 1,000 or even more people undergoing this rehabilitation.
That was reporter Jack Vince in the northeastern Nigerian city of Maiduguri. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCampoa.
In the Gambia, the lack of reliable and efficient supply of electricity is causing problems in the country's health care system. However, a non-governmental organization called Power Up Gambia is working with the government to provide renewable solar energy to resolve the power crisis. Reporter Pandera Mbai has the story.
Gambia's electricity crisis is taking a toll on the nation's virtually collapsed health sector. Daily power outages and a shortage of clean drinking water are common. Keba Baji is the chief executive officer for the Buyam Hospital. He says current efforts to increase the availability of electricity are not enough.
So he started building up the hospital, started getting another generator, which can now push up to give 4 hours of electricity, 2 hours in the day and 2 hours at night, at least to encourage the staff and also, you know, to enable the staff to be able to do some work at night. But what was more appalling was that if they want to epistomize a patient at the maternity, they do it under candlelight.
Buyam Hospital has partnered with Christina Hospital in the eastern U.S. city of Wilmington, Delaware. Lonnie Agustin is a physician at Christina. She is also the founder of DelMed Aid Gambia, an NGO supplying medical volunteers and aid to Buyam Hospital.
Some of the challenges that this hospital has is there's no native physicians here. They have to rely on international support, be it volunteers that come from around the world, or they also have Cuban physicians that come here for two-year contracts. And the problem with the Cuban physicians is they don't speak English, which is the national language here.
Besides a lack of electricity, the Gambia health system also faces acute drug shortages and a decaying infrastructure. One nurse describes the conditions of patient care in Buyam Hospital.
When it comes to resuscitation also, the newborns, sometimes we have difficulties in resuscitating them because the suction machines we have, we are using electricity. And then with those suction machines that uses electricity, when a newborn, you know, has asphyxia or difficulty in breathing, or he has some secretions in the mouth, we find it difficult. So what nurses usually do is they use a tube and do what we call mouth-to-mouth, you know, suctioning.
Meanwhile, the Gambian government and a company called Power Up Gambia have spearheaded a renewable solar energy project. Over 40 health facilities across the country have benefited from the project, including the Buyam Hospital. Lynn Mikoville is executive director of Power Up Gambia.
We've been doing other solar power projects with the Ministry of Health and trying to expand so that we can provide solar energy, reliable electricity, particularly for midwives, nurses in the more remote and rural areas.
The Gambia has struggled with electricity shortages for the past 50 years. The government of President Adama Barrow has reaffirmed its commitment to fixing the problem. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
South Sudan refugees in Uganda want Kampala to give them land for farming so they can reduce their reliance on food and cash aid. The refugees argue that the food and cash rations are not sufficient to get them through the month. Those who get cash rations say that sometimes the food in the markets is scarce and unaffordable. VOA's Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Every day, the number of South Sudan refugees in Uganda keeps rising. A majority of them rely on food and cash aid from refugee agencies and the Uganda government. But the agencies say the current food aid is inadequate to match the growing population. Food rations have been cut, while other refugees have failed to buy food using the cash rations as the food is not available in the markets. The South Sudan refugees now want Kampala to give them land to grow food and also earn some income. Bashandilu Araba is a South Sudan refugee in Mungula 1 and 2 refugee settlements in Adjumani district.
Here is the settlement, is good, but we just get only the float for build the house finish. There is no land for us to dug.
Taban Wilson, another South Sudanese refugee in Mungula settlement, agrees there is need for arable land.
Well, unfortunately, host community has not given a land for refugees to dig. We are longing to get, but there is no way out because they say they don't have piece of land. We are given only 30 by 20. No any other place where you could be able to dig. And me, my family size is 10. So in this, you know, it needs shelter, livelihood. In Uganda, it is celebs, even the citizens, including the refugee, because the influx is too much. We are not able to share the food in the market with them. You go to the market, you will not get maybe what you need, or the produce are not enough, the price has gone up, and we get problems.
Dominic Tako is the speaker of Adjumani District Local Government. He says the district officials intend to compel the government to consider giving refugees land for agriculture production.
This small area for settlement given to them, like 30 by 30 meters, should be widened. We give them bigger area so that they also produce. And we are trying to negotiate with some communities that have vast land, that all this land that are vast must be put to production. And through that, people will be generating income, people will be getting wealth. Then, alongside, food will be in surplus.
The refugees are predominantly women and young people from farming or livestock herding communities in the war-torn country. The Food and Agriculture Organization is intensifying its efforts in providing livelihood assistance to refugees and host communities. The plan focuses on food and livestock production, which could help refugees become more self-reliant. Sadiq Kasim is a director of the Abi Zono Research Institute in Arua, one of the refugee host districts. He is optimistic that if refugees are given the opportunity to farm, there will be enough food to cater for food and income needs of both refugees and host communities.
And I know there are many refugees that are within West Nile that are actually not even the camp. Or if they're in the camp, they are most of the time even with the host communities engaged in production. So they get these pieces of land and then they grow food and they're able to also sell. Empowering the refugees together with the host community to produce food, not only to feed that area, but also to generate surplus that they can even supply to the other parts of the country, will empower them economically.
According to World Food Program, $20 million are required to feed refugees in Uganda every month. The body is predicting a shortfall of food supply in November due to lack of funds. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Suleiman Terawali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.